Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. A 14-year-old boy was arrested Thursday on charges he fired a gun toward Hiawatha police officers who were responding to a call about an incident at a gas and convenience store, authorities said. Police were called at 6:38 a.m. to the Big Ten Mart, 1225 Boyson Road, for a report of a young man in the store with a gun, a news release from Hiawatha Police states. Officers arrived at the store at 6:42 a.m. and immediately were shot at by the teen, who authorities identified as Christopher Troy McDaniel, whose address was not provided. He fired at least twice from behind cover before surrendering and being taken into custody, police said in the news release. No injuries were reported. Police did not say how many officers responded to the store, but they were in uniform. McDaniel was taken to the Linn County Juvenile Detention Center, where he faces charges of attempted murder of a peace officer, third-degree burglary, third-degree theft, possession of a firearm during the commission of a crime, and carrying weapons by a prohibited person. An Iowa City teen who is accused of drag racing and causing a crash that killed a Waterloo woman last year asked a judge Thursday for temporary furlough from house arrest so he can attend prom on Saturday. But Johnson County Sheriff's Deputy Rob Schurer testified during a hearing that the principal at West High School told him that Keeson Lee Ford, 18, wasn't welcomed at the school's prom. Ford is not a student at West High. Schurer said West High also has a pre-registration requirement for prom, which Ford did not submit, the principal told him. Ford requested the temporary furlough as a modification to his pretrial release conditions, which include GPS monitoring and being on house arrest. The West High prom will be held at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Coralville from 7 to 10 p.m. Saturday, but Ford's request is from noon Saturday to noon Sunday, according to court documents. During the hearing, Schurer said Ford is allowed to go to work, medical appointments, and court proceedings. Ford wasn't attending school when he was initially put on the monitor, so that's not part of the GPS zone restrictions. The sheriff's office supervises the GPS pretrial release program, but Ford didn't ask the sheriff's office or notify it about wanting to go to prom, Schurer testified. Ford sent the deputy a text message with a screenshot showing Thursday's court hearing. Assistant Johnson County Attorney Jeff Brunel asked if someone was wearing a GPS monitor, would it pinpoint their exact location if they were in a mall or a hotel? Schurer said it wouldn't because the concrete usually interferes with the signal. Once the person was outside, they could see their location. Judge Elizabeth DePuick asked if the GPS device monitors Ford for drug or alcohol use and if they could monitor who he associated with while outside the house. Schurer said no. Brunel argued that Ford didn't have approval to attend prom from the sheriff's office or from the West High principal. He said Ford is asking for a furlough from house arrest to hang out at a hotel because he won't be allowed to go into the prom event. Brunel also pointed out that Ford was on probation from juvenile court adjudication conviction when he was arrested in the fatal crash on May 27, 2023. Jeffrey Powell, Ford's lawyer, argued that Ford didn't request approval from the sheriff's office because he didn't know it was required. He thought it was up to the court to modify his pretrial release conditions. Powell also said his client does attend school. He is taking online classes at Tate High School in Iowa City. Powell asked the judge to grant the temporary furlough for 6 to 11 p.m. on Saturday. DePuig, who ruled a few hours after the hearing, said based on the evidence presented, she will not modify his conditions of release. The court is concerned for the safety of the public and Ford. He is facing extremely serious charges which have resulted in the death of a woman. She also said that Ford's lack of preparation and planning doesn't inspire confidence in his request. The fact that Ford initially requested a 24-hour period to be on furlough is also slightly concerning, DePuig noted in the ruling. A Cedar Rapids man was arrested Wednesday in Johnson County on charges that he flashed a handgun at another driver during a road rage incident on Interstate 380. Sean Pettit, 36, is charged with assault while displaying a dangerous weapon. He had a first appearance in court Thursday and was released from jail after posting a $2,000 bond. According to a criminal complaint, Pettit was driving a gray Chevy Silverado pickup Wednesday evening near I-380's mile marker 4 near North Liberty. Another driver called 911 to report that Pettit was speeding and weaving in and out of traffic. At one point, Pettit had brake checked the caller and flashed a black handgun, the complaint said. A Johnson County Sheriff's deputy found Pettit and pulled him over farther south near mile marker 87 on Highway 218. Pettit admitted to speeding and weaving in and out of traffic and said he had a confrontation with a driver that had called 911, but said he never flashed a gun. He admitted he had a gun in his car and the deputy found a black handgun in the center console, the complaint states. Belle Plaine is at the center of Iowa's ongoing drought, which has left city wells about 14 feet lower than they should be. The city of 2300 in Benton County has received $500,000 in state grants to rebuild a wetland to better capture and retain rainfall to recharge the aquifer. The city is seeking other money for upgrades to the water treatment system. The wetland has a lot of functions, Belle Plaine City Administrator Steve Beck said. It will have aquatic plant life, which will aid in the removal of nutrients. Then it will create a zone of saturation, and it will also be a filtration site as the water percolates down through plant roots, sand, aggregate, rock, and soil. It will cleanse the water until it gets down into the aquifer, where it will be held in storage. The most recent grant, $250,000, announced April 23rd, is from the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. The agency will provide up to 50% of the cost for 14 projects statewide for a total $3.6 million from the state's Water Quality Initiative and from federal pandemic relief money. Belle Plaine received another $250,000 last November from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources to rebuild wetlands. Belle Plaine's water problems started years ago when a landowner illegally rerouted a stream near the city's well field, where four wells pull water from a shallow aquifer, Beck told the Gazette last summer. Those wells were producing only 20% of their capacity, which caused the city to not be able to flush hydrants as often as needed to keep the water from being discolored. Beck told the Hometown Current in January he suggested short-term solutions such as filtration systems and water softeners. Recent rains have given him hope the aquifer will be recharged more quickly. Belle Plaine is working with an engineering firm to develop a plan that could include drilling more shallow wells before rebuilding the surrounding wetland. The project will be on part of a 70-acre parcel northwest of the city. The wetland is just one component to our comprehensive plan, called Belle Plaine's Strategic Drought Resiliency Program, Beck said. Other elements will include water treatment for the city's deep well and water storage tank restoration. The plan also includes upgrading electrical systems and telecommunications. Beck doesn't yet know the exact timeline for the upgrades, but suggested it could take until 2026. Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley announced Thursday that Iowa will receive over $30 million from the federal infrastructure law to identify and replace lead water service lines. The EPA will administer the grant through its Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. Iowa has 64,230 service lines containing lead and 270,978 service lines of unknown material, according to a recent EPA report. Lead exposure can cause a range of serious health complications, including cardiovascular disease, decreased kidney function, and irreversible neurological damage in children. Former U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat, and Grassley, a Republican, were the only members of Iowa's congressional delegation who voted for the 2021 infrastructure bill. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has requested an expedited presidential disaster declaration for 9 Iowa counties in the wake of destructive tornadoes that caused major damage last week in Minden and Pleasant Hill. Reynolds, in her letter, requested funding under the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Individual Assistance Program and the activation of the U.S. Small Business Administration Disaster Loan Program for Clark, Crawford, Harrison, Mills, Polk, Pottawatomie, Ringgold, Shelby, and Union counties. The former provides disaster-affected homeowners, renters, and businesses access to assistance with housing, personal property replacement, medical expenses, and legal services. The latter provides homeowners, renters, businesses, and most nonprofit organizations in the affected counties whose property was damaged or destroyed the ability to apply for low-interest disaster loans. The governor also requested funding to conduct hazard mitigation activities for the entire state. Reynolds previously issued a state disaster proclamation allowing state resources to be used to respond to and recover from the effects of the severe weather. Severe storms moved across western and central Iowa on April 26th, producing 24 tornadoes in Iowa with winds of up to 160 miles per hour, resulting in significant debris, power outages, and extensive damage to property, her letter states. A water treatment plant serving the city of Minden was damaged and left inoperative from the impact of the EF3 tornado that tore through the county, Reynolds wrote. State officials found a vendor to provide water treatment to Minden residents until permanent repairs can be made. Iowa's congressional delegation also sent a letter calling on President Joe Biden to approve Reynolds' request. Members of Iowa's Latino community, immigrant workers, advocates, and allies marched and held candlelight vigils Wednesday evening in Iowa City, Davenport, Waterloo, and Des Moines in protest over a new law making illegal immigration a state crime. Organizers emphasize that America's immigration system is in dire need of repair. They say what is needed is comprehensive immigration reform, one that recognizes the contribution of immigrants rather than criminalizing them. We need to send a message that Iowa welcomes immigrants and refugees, said Manny Galvez, leader of Eastern Iowa Immigrants Group. We cannot allow hate to destroy our communities. He added, "We are working families. We are immigrants. We are the same as everybody. We came to this country because we want a better future, not to be used as a political punching bag." Iowa City Mayor Bruce Teague said immigrants play an essential role in filling workforce gaps and sustaining economic growth in communities across Iowa. Iowa's meatpacking plants, farms, construction sites, and service sectors rely on immigrant labor. He said Iowa City is committed to creating an environment that welcomes and supports immigrants and provides opportunities that enable them to thrive and contribute to the well-being of our community. Iowa City reaffirms its commitment to protecting the rights, dignity, and safety of all immigrants, including refugees, asylum seekers, and undocumented individuals, and opposes any policies or practices that seek to undermine their humanity or civil liberties, Teague said. Governor Kim Reynolds last month signed into law Senate File 2340. The law, which takes effect July 1st, makes it a crime for someone to attempt to enter Iowa after being previously deported or barred from entering the United States. The law makes it an aggravated misdemeanor, which carries up to a 2-year sentence. In some cases, including people with certain prior convictions, the state crime would become a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. Immigration enforcement generally is the responsibility of the federal government, and opponents have argued Iowa lacks the authority to enforce the law. A similar law passed in Texas is temporarily blocked while a federal appeals court weighs a challenge to a lower court's ruling that struck down the measure. The lower court found the law threatens the fundamental notion that the United States must regulate immigration with one voice. The immigrant group is exploring legal action in the courts and has requested meetings with the U.S. Department of Justice, Iowa Department of Public Safety, and local police chiefs and county sheriffs. Reynolds and other Republicans argue that the measure is needed to respond to record numbers of illegal crossings and accuse Democratic President Joe Biden of abandoning his responsibility to secure the border. Every state is a border state. Every state is being impacted by crime, by illegal drugs coming from Mexico, Reynolds told reporters Wednesday. Fentanyl is pouring into our communities. It's killing our children. We have to stop it, and I want to send a message that we welcome legal immigration. We are a gracious country when it comes to that, but if we are a country without a border and a country without laws, we might as well be a third world country. Reynolds stressed she and other governors across the country have an obligation to step in and do what we can to protect our citizens. Immigrant rights advocates warn the Iowa law will lead to widespread racial profiling and stereotyping and consume already strapped state court and law enforcement resources. The law does not provide funding or a requirement to train officers on immigration law, despite authorizing them to make decisions about a person's immigration status. Opponents also raised concerns that parents may be separated from their children if arrested under the new state crime. Gloria Villatoro of Coralville said she and her four children were devastated when her husband, Iowa City pastor Max Villatoro, was deported to Honduras in 2015. While he's since returned to the United States, Gloria said no other family should have to endure the pain and loss of being torn apart. "Stop separating families," she told a group of roughly 100 demonstrators who gathered in downtown Iowa City on Wednesday. While the law does not empower Iowa law enforcement to arrest all undocumented immigrants, just those who were previously denied entry or subject to removal, opponents say that can include those with legal status who are pursuing asylum. The legislation states a court may not halt prosecution under the law on the basis that a federal determination regarding the immigration status of the person is pending or will be initiated. It also means people who re-entered Iowa decades ago could be arrested and charged with the new crime. Iowa's Catholic bishops say they oppose the new law, stating it undermines family unity, reduces humanitarian protections, and provides no viable solutions for long-time residents without legal status. It is especially problematic that SF-2340 would explicitly allow state officials to prosecute an individual for state immigration crimes, even if that person's application for immigration relief is pending before federal authorities or they have actually received federal authorization to be present, according to a statement from the Iowa Catholic Conference. We ask officials to ensure the protection of human rights and dignity of the persons involved, according to the statement from Iowa's four Catholic bishops. Families should receive special consideration and not be separated. While Catholics may disagree within the limits of reforming the nation's immigration system, the bishops again ask for border protection policies that are consistent with humanitarian values and with the need to treat all individuals with respect while allowing the authorities to carry out the critical task of identifying and preventing entry of terrorists and dangerous criminals. For those convicted under the new law, Iowa judges will be required to issue an order requiring the person return to the country from which he or she entered the United States. Such orders must specify the manner in which they'll be transported to a U.S. port of entry and list the officer and state agencies responsible for ensuring the violator leaves the country. Undocumented immigrants could face felony charges for noncompliance. Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison who floor managed the bill in the House, said that a confirmation of citizenship would only be triggered if a person is arrested for a separate crime, which is already part of the legal process. Law enforcement in the state, though, have said they lack the tools and resources to enforce the law. Holt acknowledged there are unanswered questions, such as how the state would deport people. He said that language in the bill was left intentionally vague to provide leeway for Iowa courts to work with the Department of Public Safety and arresting agencies to sort out those details. Holt and Reynolds said state officials will continue to work with Iowa law enforcement to provide clarity and direction, and if needed, pass additional legislation or rulemaking authority. Republican lawmakers last month appropriated $2 million to the Iowa Department of Public Safety for immigration enforcement. The bill states the money can be used to hire up to 12 full-time positions to conduct coordination oversight, technical assistance, and investigatory assistance to current or new task forces to address the rise in illegal immigration and related criminal conduct, such as drug trafficking and human trafficking. The money may also be assigned at the discretion by Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Banz. The money, though, is not specifically tied to enforcing the new state-level crime of illegal reentry. Ethan Eliaquim, a co-college sophomore from Brazil, doesn't have a car to get around town. So when he heard about a new Cedar Rapids nonprofit's effort to sell bikes at an affordable rate, he knew he needed to scope out the organization's newly fixed offerings. After he arrived at the new Chain Reaction Bike Hub shop Wednesday, Eliaquim, 20, grabbed a Schwinn bike, gravitating toward the one with a similar size and frame to bikes he rode at back home, and tested it outside the shop. Dave DeWitt, the group member in charge of bike repairs, adjusted his brakes, and then Eliaquim was on his way with the new wheels. It only cost him $53.50, and having several strangers take his photo, to be the first customer. Ilya Kim, who studies data science and economics, was looking for a better way to access parks and other Cedar Rapids destinations. He started biking at age 4 for fun, but then it became how he got to school and everywhere else around his hometown of Belo Horizonte, Brazil's 6th largest city. Back home, he said there are lots of trails and ample bike lanes built into the roads that help cyclists access destinations with ease. Not having a car here, he said it's extremely important to have a bike to get around town. A new nonprofit aims to break barriers people like Ilya Kim face to accessing reliable bikes and transportation in Linn County, and envisions bikes as a means to strengthen social bonds and reduce inequities. Chain Reaction Bike Hub is a non-traditional bike shop that looks to improve access to affordable transportation, especially for those who are low income, youth, and young adults at risk for engaging in gun or group violence, as well as others who are traditionally marginalized. To work toward that mission, the new nonprofit serving Linn County and the surrounding area opened its location Wednesday evening at 1010 3rd Avenue Southwest within the Precision Drywall Warehouse. It opened in conjunction with Bike to Work Month. Cedar Rapids is rich with cyclists, he said, so this seems like a natural way to get more people involved and to address inequities through that lens of fixing and riding bikes. The organization was first conceptualized last summer. The Bike Hub takes discarded bicycles from Cedar Rapids Linn County Solid Waste Agency and accepts private donations and repairs those bikes for people who cannot otherwise afford a bike. The general public may purchase these bikes, and eventually, like the Iowa City Brake Library, there will be an option to borrow bikes. As of Wednesday morning, Schmidtke said about 25 bikes were ready to be sold. Revenue goes toward the organization's programming. The Bike Hub separates them based on the brand tier, but still has dozens of bikes to sort through and determine whether to use for parts or sell. Schmidtke said the organization's board members come from an array of local organizations, including Linn County Public Health and the Sustainability Program at the Linn County Solid Waste Agency, as the board looked to push its membership beyond only cyclists and more broadly represent the community. People may buy merchandise, make donations, or volunteer for the organization. More volunteers are needed to sell bikes, take donations, and work on bike repairs, and to further expand hours and offer classes. In addition to the bike shop and library at its physical location, the Bike Hub will run programming using community partnerships that envision bikes as a way to prevent violence, mentor youth, and develop skills, Schmidtke said. By dedicating resources for youth outreach and gun violence prevention, Schmidtke said he hopes it inspires future ambitions and expands mentorship and job opportunities, equipping youth with the skills to become a bike mechanic, for instance. He wants youth to feel welcome and know the shop is a safe space that they can come and hang out. Board member Maxine Prime, who works at Willis Dady Homeless Services as a permanent supportive housing case manager, said the Bike Hub is looking to hold classes to teach people how to properly maintain bikes. She said lots of bikes end up in the landfill simply because people don't know how to replace a chain or change tires, for example. So this could help reduce waste while improving transportation access. Prime said the Bike Hub is working on partnering with Kirkwood Community College to work with international students who can't have driver's license, so they could rent a bike from the Bike Hub. And through Willis Dady, the unhoused population could have a dedicated time to come to the Bike Hub and learn these skills too. Prime said there are also efforts to create bike racks and provide chains so those experiencing homelessness can have somewhere to store their bikes. They lack tools or additional parts needed to make repairs, and then the bikes they rely on for transportation don't last long term, she said. Some unhoused people who struggle with mental illness aren't able to be at the ground transportation center and use bikes for 100% of their transportation, Prime said. Others may have fare-free Cedar Rapids transit passes, but the buses don't operate on Sundays or late at night, so they're not always available for people who work outside of 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekday hours. As a mother with a 17-year-old son and 13-year-old daughter, Prime said she wants her kids to learn volunteerism and wants to instill in them the values of contributing to their community. She hasn't recruited her son to help yet, but her daughter has started to volunteer. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 3rd, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Carol Lee Bell Van Cleve passed away on April 30, 2024, at the age of 94. She was born on January 13, 1930, and raised in Albia. Carol was a loving wife to her late husband, Robert Eugene Van Cleve, for 62 years. She taught alongside her husband as an English teacher in the Amana Community School District for over 30 years. A visitation for family and friends will be held on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg, followed by a graveside service at the Jackson Township Cemetery in Montezuma. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to Essence of Life Hospice, Iowa Public Radio, or Safe Haven of Iowa County in memory of Carol Lee Bell Van Cleve. Mark James Taylor, M.D., ABFP, 82, of Marion, passed away May 1st at Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha following a lengthy battle with Alzheimer's disease. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, May 6th at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. Following the service, Mark's generous donation to the University of Iowa Deeded Body Program will be fulfilled. Stuart Roger Green, 83, died April 28th with his family at his side after a three-year battle with cancer. Services will be held Monday, May 6th, 11 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. at the chapel. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. He was born July 30th, 1940 in Cedar Rapids. He attended McKinley High School, was drafted, and spent 8 years in the Army. He retired from Hy-Vee in 2012. In lieu of flowers, please do a kind act or help a veteran. Ruth Elizabeth Lindhart was born June 20, 1931 in Williamsburg. She graduated from Williamsburg High School in 1949 and attended Iowa State University for 2 years. Ruth was united in marriage to Otis Neal Lindhart on March 24, 1951 in Williamsburg. Ruth served as a library secretary at the Williamsburg High School for 20 years and was a lifelong farm wife. She was a member of the First Presbyterian Church, where she served as an elder and deacon and was past president of the Presbyterian Women. Ruth was also a member of the Eastern Star, where she was past worthy matron and a member of the PEO. Ruth had a passion for serving others. A celebration of life service will be 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 4th, at the First Presbyterian Church in Williamsburg. Burial will be at Oak Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be Friday from 4 to 7 at the Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. A memorial fund has been established for the First Presbyterian Church or the Williamsburg Public Library. John Jack Theodore Kuhn, 92, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, April 29th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Services will be 10 a.m. Monday at St. Jude Catholic Church. Burial will be in the Sacred Heart Cemetery in Walker. A vigil service will be held at 4 p.m. on Sunday at Tian Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family from 4:30 p.m. until 7 p.m. or after 9 a.m. at the church on Monday. Jack was born on August 22, 1931, in Walker. He graduated from Immaculate Conception High School in Cedar Rapids, where he was captain of the basketball team and attended Loras College. On May 21, 1955, he married Connie Takas in Walker. Jack served in the United States Army during the Korean conflict. Following his military service, he worked as a lieutenant at the Cedar Rapids Police Department until his retirement in 1987. Memorials may be directed to the family for Jack's favorite charities. Barbara Jean Wolf Rink, of Cedar Rapids, 82 years old, passed away in her home on Wednesday, May 1st, in the presence of family. Visitation will be from 4:30 to 6 p.m. Monday, May 6th, with rosary at 4 p.m. at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will be at 10 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th, at St. Matthew Catholic Church. The burial will be in Green Center Cemetery of Morley. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts can be designated to nursing at Mount Mercy Hospital. Please reference in memory of Barbara Rink. Barbara was born on May 16, 1941. After graduating from Regis High School in 1959, Barb attended Mount Mercy School of Nursing, obtaining her RN in 1962. Her nursing career was varied and included ER work, surgical nursing, tending to inmates at the county jail, home health care, and even a nursing home. Barb met the love of her life, Joseph Sluggo Rink, on a blind date. They were married on May 9, 1964, in Marion at St. Joseph's. Although they were married in Iowa, they planted their roots in Colorado. Barb and Joseph were members of St. Joan of Arc Parish in Arvada, Colorado, where all five of their children had their first communions and confirmations. After the passing of her husband, Barb became a member of St. Anne's Catholic Church in Arvada, Colorado. In 2020, Barb decided to leave her home in Colorado and move nearer her roots in a condo on Thompson Drive in Cedar Rapids. Barb joined the parish of St. Matthew's and enjoyed participating in the mission of her new church. Donald Roz, Alan Rosno, went to his eternal rest on April 30th, 2024. Visitation for Don will be held at the Fry Funeral Home in Tipton on Friday, May 3rd, from 4 to 7 p.m. There will be a funeral service on May 4th at 1 p.m. at the Fry Funeral Home, in which all friends and family are welcome. The family is requesting no flowers be sent and that any desired donations to be made on behalf of Don and directed to the Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. James Dean Pregan, 68, of Coralville, passed away suddenly Monday, April 29th. A memorial service will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Iowa City Fire Department or Rotary Kerber HeartSafe Community Campaign to offer community training. Donald Raymond Don Holtz, 73, of Lone Tree, passed away on Tuesday, April 30th at the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City due to the complications of cancer. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, May 6th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Lone Tree. A visitation will be held on Sunday, May 5th from 3 until 6 p.m. at the Snyder and Hollenbaugh Funeral and Cremation Services of Lone Tree, where a prayer service will be held at 6 p.m. on Sunday. Interment will be held at Lone Tree Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Don's family. Don was born December 6, 1950, in Iowa City. He graduated from Lone Tree High School in 1969. After attending Iowa State University for a year, he returned home to farm due to his father's illness. He was a lifelong farmer. He was also a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Lone Tree. Other death notices from Cedar Rapids. Michael Ingalls, 70, died Wednesday, May 1st. Gotch Funeral Home of Monticello in charge. From Guttenberg, Gail A. Sims, 71, died Sunday, April 7th. Jameson Schmitz, Funeral Home of Old Wine in charge. Hedrick Connie Messerschmidt, 81, died Wednesday, May 1st. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Sigourney in charge. From Maquoketa, Paul Eds, 75, died Wednesday, May 1st. Carson Celebration of Life Center in charge. Also Maquoketa, Susan Sue Hare, 74, died Tuesday, April 30th. Carson Celebration of Life Center in charge. From Marengo, William E. Cook, 77, died Wednesday, May 1st. Powell Funeral Home of Williamsburg in charge. From Marion, Joanne Morgan Lipke, 75, died Wednesday, May 1st. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Services in charge. And from Sumner, Rosalie Rast, 87, of Mason City, formerly of Sumner, died Wednesday, May 1st. Helms Funeral Home of Decorah is in charge. And from celebrity deaths, Brian McCarty, a Scottish actor best known for his roles in the BBC drama Line of Duty and the 1995 film Rob Roy, died unexpectedly Sunday at the age of 59. His death was announced by his sister, Sarah McCarty, on Tuesday in an ex post. Brian passed away suddenly at home on Sunday, 28th of April. A wonderful and passionate actor on stage and screen, Brian loved his work and touched many lives. United Agents, which represented McCarty during his career, also confirmed the news of his passing on social media, calling him an actor of such great talent. So far, no details have been shared about the actor's cause of death. Born near Glasgow in 1965, McCarty first began acting professional at the age of 24, landing a part on the British TV show EastEnders. He would go on to amass over 82 film and TV credits in his career. He later earned praise for his role as Tommy Hunter in the Police Procedural Line of Duty from 2012 to 2014. He became known to U.S. audiences through his appearances on Shameless and Outlander and had a part in the upcoming Outlander prequel, Blood of My Blood. In the film Rob Roy, McCarty played the son of Liam Neeson's titular character. His other film roles include Doors Open, 200 Cigarettes, Kiss of Death, and Low Winter Sun. Racing season is here, finally. 6 days after inclement weather postponed what was originally scheduled to be opening day at Hawkeye Down Speedway, drivers will start their engines for competition tonight, officially kicking off HD's 99th season. Corey Crispin, 2023 Hornets track champion, believes there's plenty for competitors and fans to be excited about this year. "I'm looking forward to new drivers and cars joining the competition," Crispin said. "That can really shake things up." Hawkeye Downs race director Brian Gibson estimates a double-digit car count increase from last year. Another development at HD in 2024, an alteration to its quarter-mile track. We modified the racing lines on the quarter-mile to promote two-wide racing, Gibson said. We moved the bottom of the track out in the center of the corner, so instead of a constant circle, it's more of an oval, and there is slightly more banking when you get off the bottom 4 to 5 feet of the track. The Speedway also added a new racing class, HD Dogs. Fans should be excited to know that Hawkeye Downs is incorporated a new half-mile breakout class, last year's Hobby Stocks champion Derek Parrott said. In this class, a designated time is set, and the objective for the drivers is to run as close to that time as they can without breaking out or going under. Currently, we have the time set at 22 seconds, Gibson said. This is a class to encourage a lot of our fans who want to see racing out on the half mile. HD Dogs also is an economical way to run the halftime, according to Gibson. While vehicle parameters, late models are not allowed to compete, and safety measures are required to be met, the class has a wide open set of rules, Gibson said. It could be an older dirt car. It could be an older asphalt car. It could be a truck. This class is designed so a person can participate without having to spend crazy money on an engine and new tires all the time, but still get out on the half mile. Points races will be held every Friday until August 16th, when a track champion from each class is scheduled to be crowned. This year's schedule has 17 races. Visiting racing series this year include the Sprint Series, AIRS Vintage Racing Series, Big 8 Late Model Series, and the ASA Midwest Tour. A criminal investigator for the state of Iowa suggested to colleagues last year that busting college athletes for online sports betting would impress the public and the powers that be, and perhaps nudge lawmakers toward updating gambling rules. If they get suspended or get a scholarship taken away, so be it. Division of Criminal Investigation Special Agent Christopher Adkins wrote in his February 2023 email. Attorneys for more than two dozen Iowa and Iowa State athletes caught in a 2023 gambling sting obtained Adkins' email and 32 others from the Department of Public Safety through an open records request and released them to the Associated Press on Thursday. They were among attorneys who filed a lawsuit last week against the state and its public safety and criminal investigation agencies for violating the athletes' rights and damaging their reputations. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages. The emails illustrate authorities' motivation for pursuing the cases and using geolocating software that led to the identification of athletes using mobile wagering apps with accounts registered under different names, usually those of relatives. The athletes disguised their identities either because they were underage, they were NCAA athletes, or both. Most sports gambling by athletes is against NCAA rules. The athletes' lawyers contend tracking software data was illegally obtained because no search warrant was issued. DPS Commissioner Stephen Bands, who oversees the DCI, has defended investigators' tactics. Five starters on the Iowa State football team and a number of Iowa football and basketball players were among athletes criminally charged or suspended by the NCAA. Most of the athletes paid fines after entering guilty pleas to underage gambling in exchange for having identity theft charges dismissed. Attorneys for four Iowa State athletes who did not take plea deals contended investigators exceeded the scope of permitted use of tracking software, and there never was a criminal complaint that would have provided cause for a search. A judge upheld their motion to dismiss all charges in March. Adkins, in his 2023 email to fellow special agents Troy Nelson and Brian Sanger, wrote that the investigation would bring attention to our unit not only in the public's eyes, but also as far as the commissioner and even possibly the legislature's. Sanger, in an email in a month earlier, speculated the case could lead to the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission and DCI gaining access to all Iowa sports wagering accounts so we can ensure no college coaches, athletes, officials, athletic trainers, individuals close inside a college sports program along with statewide barred patrons don't have Iowa sports wagering accounts. Several emails from DCI investigators revealed a brief belief that state laws needed to be updated to make it illegal for a person to place wagers on another's behalf. Online sportsbooks user agreements bar so-called proxy betting, but typically a complaint must be lodged before the sportsbook investigates. Several emails outlined concerns that using information from geolocating software could violate athletes' constitutional rights, particularly the Fourth Amendment, which protects citizens from unreasonable searches and seizures. IRGC Director of Operations Tima Eich wrote in September 2022 to Special Agent Chris Swigert that she assumed a county attorney would be concerned if the geolocation evidence were improperly obtained and that a defendant might be able to get that evidence thrown out. Adkins wrote the investigation would seem like a lot of work, but on a case like this where it will be higher profile, we can show our worth to the powers that be with sending out a warning that we will be overseeing things and hopefully work on slowing down these sort of things in the future. And if we pursue this and it hits the media, which it would, and people start asking why nothing criminal was done, we can ask that as a platform to hopefully push legislators to for code changes moving forward. Adkins reiterated that the investigation should press on. It might ruffle some feathers, but so be it, he wrote. Adkins did not immediately respond to a message left on his cell phone seeking comment. The Kentucky Derby has survived world wars and controversies of all kinds. America's longest continuously held sporting event turns 150 years old this Saturday. By age, it's got the Westminster Dog Show beat by 2 years. The Derby has survived two world wars, the Depression, and pandemics, including COVID-19 in 2020, when it ran in virtual silence without the usual crowd of 150,000. The first Saturday in May is Derby Day, with all its accompanying pageantry, including fancy hats, fans dressed in their Sunday best, mint juleps served in souvenir glasses, the crowd singing My Old Kentucky Home, and the hand-sewn garland of red roses for the winner. The Derby was the second most watched sporting event of 2023 behind the Super Bowl. Part of what makes the Derby unique is horses have just one chance to run in it, since only 3-year-olds are eligible. It's also the only race in America with a 20-horse field. Since 2013, horses have to accumulate points in qualifying races to earn their way in. Previously, money won in graded stakes races decided the field. The Derby's image took a major hit last year when 12 horses died at Churchill Downs in the weeks surrounding the race. An independent investigation cleared the track of any fault, and no singular cause was found. The track continued training, but moved the remainder of its spring racing meet to Western Kentucky. Churchill Downs Incorporated, the tract's publicly traded parent company with shareholders to satisfy, has spent $500 million renovating and modernizing over the last decade. Its newest showpiece is the $200 million paddock, where fans who don't mind dropping up to $12,000 can dine and watch the horses being saddled before the races. In its 150th year, the Derby's purse has been boosted to a record $5 million, with $3.1 million going to the winning owner. Despite all the changes with the race, the track, and the intrusion of current events over the years, the first Saturday in May endures. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.